When your body makes too many mistakes, I start to form. It doesn't matter where or how, but eventually I will have your doctor saying something is out of the norm. First is a checkup, ER, then test galore.
Something you don't have to worry about is being bored.
The music orchestrated by me begins. Its symphony of anxiety starts as anxious feet begin to tap and start up the beat. The vocals caused by prayers, hoping and praying that it's truly not me. But it's obvious to the doctors as they view through their electronic screens. Eventually, the heart takes over the beat as soon as it drops. Silence floods the room, but the chatter of the doctors just doesn't seem to stop. The doctors assure you it will be okay, but your mind doesn't respond because it's just a blank space. From this point on, I've changed your life. You didn't have a choice in getting me, but you do have a choice to fight.
Welcome to the Kartai Hopecast, where we explore stories that shape us, journeys of resilience, hope, and perseverance. We seek the lessons that emerge when we face the unexpected and find strength in the struggle.
At just 14, Abigail Wells was faced with an unimaginable choice: continue chemotherapy that wasn't working, or undergo an amputation in hopes of survival. In the years since, she's turned her pain into purpose, using art, poetry, humor, and advocacy to remind others that even in darkness, joy can still be found. Abigail, thank you for sharing that powerful piece. That was extraordinary.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, welcome to the Hopecast. We look forward to the conversation.
I'm excited to have this conversation with you.
Well, poetry has clearly been such an important outlet for you. What role has writing and creative expression played in helping you process the journey you've been on?
Poetry, whenever you're able to write out all of your expressions, your emotions, things to come out that you don't even realize that you're feeling. And whenever I was young and all of those things were going on, I really didn't know how to describe what I was feeling because it was indescribable and something that was inconceivable to my brain. And I didn't really realize that people my age went through. So writing down poetry was allowed me to be able to just express that and realize what's really going on in the inside.
Well, I look forward to hearing more about that and diving into that. I want to start at just looking at what life looked like before age 14, leading up to your eventual diagnosis. What was your world like? Just school, friends, activities, as a 14-year-old before your world completely changed?
So I ran track. I love track still to this day. I hope to go to the Paralympics one day. Mm. That's my fingers crossed. But my life was just, one could say, normal, but also I'm a very busy body, involved in all of the clubs, all of the organizations. I was bragging to my friends like that I was able to leave class early from Spanish because I was like, hey guys, I get to leave, and because I had to go to the appointment where I was eventually diagnosed. But to me, I was just like, hey, I'm leaving. I get to leave school. It's just my life was very carefree, just because that's kind of my personality. And it did turn into one where I couldn't be that carefree and I had to be very mindful of everything all of a sudden. Whenever I was running track, I felt so free. I ran the 100 meter and the 200 meter, so it was very quick and fast. But it was an outlet just to allow me to just not forget about everything. Like as soon as they shoot the starting gun and you go and it's ready, set, go, you're going and then it's over. And but for that split second, everything just disappears. And that's what track is to me. It's just that outlet of freedom. And whenever I was running my last race, I actually won it. It was a 200 meter, but I had pain in my ankle. And that's whenever we were just like, oh, something could be wrong. And I was just like, oh, it's probably just a sprain. And that next week, we were talking about how
ugly each other's feet are. Mine aren't cute. And so they were really honing in on mine. And that's whenever we were like, okay, we should probably get your ankle checked because that bump on it, it just doesn't look good. Hmm. And that next week we were in the ER. And then after that, I was starting treatment that following week.
Wow.
And so track just kind of stopped for me. And whenever I was finding out that news that my leg would have to be amputated, mm-hmm. I was like, okay, can I run track still? Like, is it possible? I saw the running blades and I was just like, oh,
yeah,
I can still run track. And so that was another way that I was really comforted in that time. Like, okay, I can still do things. And track was like a sign like, okay, if I can get a prosthetic, I can do it. Just like if mm-hmm. I can get the right leg, I can still go upstairs. And if I can do this, it just showed that there's still things I can do after mm-hmm. this. And now I have been training for the Paralympics and I have like a pink running blade and I've gone to meets and I've helped out little kids who are starting to get their blades or who haven't even got their prosthetics and run with them
yeah.
to show like that they're capable and that they can do it. So track is very pivotal in my life.
Can you talk now about just the way you use creative expression, just the types of art and yeah. what that means to you?
So in the hospital, I did a lot of side quests, as people would say today. Okay. I side projects. I made this one painting. It was out of oil and it was a before, a during, and an after. So it was a girl with like a puff, which is my staple. It's all throughout all my elementary to college pictures. Always have a puff in my pictures. So I was like, okay, that's my before. And then it was during, and then it was after. During was a bald head, and after was a girl with like short hair, curly hair coming in. And it was titled Overcoming, and it was just a process of overcoming. And it was able to be hanged in the Arkansas Children's, and I got to present it downtown in their art way. And I was still going through treatment, so that was very cool to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And then I also made a little, it was all out of toothpicks. It was a model of the bridge. I could see it straight from my hospital room. And it was like the Arkansas Bridge that you would go over so many times, and I made it all out of toothpicks. And that was just a little fun project. Made the river blue and the glistening and everything. And of course, writing poetry, creativity was just an outlet just for me to just, honestly, in a way that track was where I could escape. Creativity was another way that I could just escape, put my mind off of it, and just honestly be consumed in that moment. And I really enjoyed all of those projects. Mm.
What do you remember most vividly about hearing the words, "You have osteosarcoma," and how did it shift your sense of being as this carefree 14-year-old?
Everything went quiet. It was just, I didn't know how to react. I didn't know how to respond. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, okay, let me do research. I was currently in a biology class in high school, and I'm a little bit of a nerd. So I was just like, okay, what is this? And research was one way that I could possibly grasp this. And even though I could Google things, it really didn't allow me to get a great understanding of what truly to expect and know. So I didn't really know what to do except to move forward and digest it, lean on my family, lean on my parents and my brother and all of the friends that I had around me. Mm-hmm. And I just really didn't know what to do. It was just take every day at a time.
Well, after rounds of chemotherapy, you soon learned that it wasn't enough. How were you presented with the choice of amputation, and how did you process something like that, just so life-altering, and especially at that age?
Yeah. So my family, well, actually my parents, we were in the room and I heard them. They were just like very quiet to themselves. And I was just like, hey guys, what's up? Like, what's going on? I could tell something was wrong. And they did inform me. They were like, hey,
the chemotherapy's not working. You're going to have these options. And I sat there and I meditated on it. And I was just like, okay, what could I do? I had to lean on the things, my pillars in life, my family, my faith, the wisdom that I've had as a 13-year-old. And I was just like, I would rather lose my leg and gain my life. In the future, I really don't want this to come back and me to have kids and a family. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, this same thing happens to me all over again. I just wanted to have a future where this was not occur again. And so it was easy to me at the time, hard for my parents to grasp, but it was just simple. I guess even at my age, it made it just like A equals B. So why don't I do it?
But what a devastating and terrible choice to have to make at that age. I mean, cancer treatment is hard for anyone to walk through, but going through it while you're still figuring out who you are as a teenager certainly would add another layer. What was it like to just navigate your whole treatment journey and before and after the amputation and what you were facing?
I'm a person who, if I'm in a dark situation, I want to find a way to bring a light to it. Mm-hmm. And so I decorated my whole entire hospital room. And it was like we were moving in every time we had a buggy. And I had my yellow spread. I said, open up the windows every time we went in for treatment. I want to see the light. And we had just pictures of my family and friends all everywhere. I wanted it to be my space. I started a gratitude wall and the nurses would come in and they would write things that they were grateful for, not just things that I'm grateful for, but things that they're grateful for. So I could just remember why I should be grateful for the things, even though everything's so hard right now. And so I just chose, because every day we have a choice. And I was just like, today I'm going to wake up and I'm going to choose to look at the good instead of the bad. And of course, there's the other things I did as a teenager, watch a bunch of Netflix movies and of course, eat a whole lot of snacks, convince my parents into getting a dog because I did a whole entire pull on the floor. I was like to the doctors and the nurses, if I get a dog, would this help me heal? Would this help the process? And all of them apparently just say yes. And so I ended up getting a dog out of it. So that was kind of the process. But that's the good, the light, but also it was hard. And those things that I did made the heart just feel a little bit less difficult. Mm-hmm. And it made there to be a little bit more light in it because there were those moments where I was in the room and I could not move because my bones were aching so bad, or I was so sick to my stomach that I could barely even just look at a phone because the light from it just made me feel sick. And so there's those moments, but whenever those moments passed, I made sure that there was something bright, that there was something happy, that there was something that could uplift my spirit whenever it passed. So,
Yeah, certainly that's the more of the mental health journey of that, not just the physical. Well, I'm sure that was incredibly uplifting for everyone who was in your sphere during that time.
Yeah.
Beyond poetry, you've painted, built, and even as you've kind of described, using humor, both in person and online. How has creativity helped you make sense of your experience and connect with others who may be struggling as well?
One thing creativity does, I feel like it breaks a barrier. It allows me to be able to communicate with other people if they don't understand what I'm going through. Mm-hmm. So I may compare something to another thing and they're just like, oh, okay, wait, that makes sense. Because a lot of people don't go through the things that I went through, and it allows me to share my story and be like, hey, this is actually, you can think about it like this. And they're like, oh, wow, now I can understand it. And I feel like it takes that creative mind to be able to make that connection and to be able to just, creativity allows me to just connect with people. And I just value it to the point to where any opportunity I have to be creative, I take advantage of it because A, shows something about me, but also allows me to connect with others. Mm-hmm. And then also, like, for instance, I've been writing a poetry book that's accumulation of all the poetry that I wrote throughout treatment and after treatment, since getting out of treatment was really difficult for me. And hopefully that creativity that I have produced will be able to help people who are out, like, who are going through those experiences or who want to understand it. And so I feel like that's a perfect example of how that creativity can help others, but help myself, but also just help anybody who lays their eyes on it.
You're certainly already creative before you started going through this journey, but it sounds like in the midst of that hard, that kind of puts your creative side on steroids, yeah, looking for a way to tell that story, mm-hmm, to others. Well, in the midst of your own challenges, you've continued to look outward, whether through acts of kindness or advocating for adaptive sports. Where does that drive to serve others? Where does that come from?
It comes from my family. Mm-hmm. I would also go back to, like, those pillars that I say, like, family, that faith, the just the environment I've grown around, up around, all of those things, like those foundational pillars that you grow up with in your life, I feel like really impact how you react to situations, mm-hmm, and how you present yourself or how you respond to things. And so I feel like that's how I'm able to have that, like, active service mind, because I'm just like, how can I help others with this? And that's why I'm so big. How can I use my story? That was a big thing that helped me throughout treatment. I started recording YouTube videos and blogging all of it, because I was just like, okay, this is not amazing. One of my vlogs, I was just like, oh yeah, this chemotherapy is not that bad. 30 minutes later, guys, this is not great. Mm-hmm. And so it's just like through blogging and through, like, showing all those outlets, I was just like, okay, that means I can, like, help others with what I'm going through. I can, like, share my experience. And so I really appreciate just being able to give to others, because it gives purpose to life, but also it helps me while helping others, and there's really no fault in it. Yeah.
Did you find that being really honest about the hard parts of what you were going through, did you find a new audience or a new way to connect with people you
hadn't? I did. It was, I found a whole bunch of, like, there are people all the way in, like, Great Britain that I connected with, Canada, and we all just combined and just shared our stories. There's a girl who's up in Seattle, and she's going through the exact same thing that I was going through, and I'm being able to share my story, and she would share hers, and it was very healing for all of us to just be in community. I believe having a community of people who share that same experience is so important, because you can be able to know that you're not alone.
Yeah.
So that's very important.
You spoke about your family earlier and the power of your family. How did the example of your parents and your brother shape your resilience and your outlook on giving back?
So I would say my mom, she always tells, her quote is, I see you, I hear you, and you matter. Mm. And that shows in my, like, acts of service. Like, I'm just like, okay, I want to see people. I want to, if somebody is, like, feels like they're not being seen, I want to make sure that they feel seen. Mm. I want to make sure they know they matter. I want to make sure that they know that they're heard. And then my dad, he's the fixer-upper. I'm like, really, he can fix anything. And so, like, just from learning about, like, how can I, like, just, like, fix people, not fix people, but, like, honestly, like, how can I use a situation to, like, help somebody else's situation?
Yeah.
And then my brother, he's, like, a quiet, he's a tall, deep voice. Taller than me, even though he's my baby brother, but he's just like someone who will listen. Mm-hmm. And so I just, like, have picked all of the things I've learned from them, and it helped me throughout my journey, but also in my day-to-day walk today.
Well, how do you see now, looking back, these past experiences shaping the kind of work that you want to do in the future?
I hope to be a healthcare lawyer. Hopefully getting a master's in public health and getting a JD. I've seen just there's different policies that we can do to just A, make sure that people have the resources that they have, but also advocacy. And I feel like there's many people who do not have that advocacy to, or that advocate on their behalf. And I just feel like these experiences, as I go back to what I've said priorly, I don't want to go through anything and then not like be able to use it to help somebody. And so that's how I hope to do it in the future. And through my adaptive sports, I didn't have that resource whenever I was going through treatment. And I was just like, let me provide that resource.
Yeah.
And so I just want to be the answer. My professor, she said, if you're not at the table, you're on the table. And so I want to make sure that like the people who fall in the demographics that I am in are not on the table, because I can be the voice just like each and every other person can be the voice to represent who they are and those subgroups they fall into.
That's powerful. Well, if you could go back, Abigail, and sit with the 14-year-old girl who had just started chemotherapy, what would you say to her?
I would say to her, just keep being a light and keep going. And this is not a fight that you will lose, and that you need to make sure that you just live in the moment and treasure every moment and every second, which I believe that I did. But it's just something I would reiterate, because those moments, even then those dark times, there were moments with my nurses where we would be dancing around, or there would be moments where they would put me in a little chair and we would like run through the hallways. And those are like little moments that I can look back on. And even though it's the hardest time of my life, just smile about. And I just would make sure that she knows that like she should grow from this and not be depleted, and know that this is an opportunity to just become more and not just not let it write your story, but just be a chapter.
Wow. Well, Abigail Wells, your story is powerful and it's full of hope. Before we close, is there one message you'd like to share with our listeners who may be facing their own life-changing circumstance?
Yeah, I would just say, even in those hard and those dark times, there's always something that's a twinkling of light. And that's what I would say to set their eyes on. Even though it's hard and even though it's difficult, just setting your eyes on, just even if it's an inkling and it's just a sparkle like those stars in the night, those stars are still something that you have to look up at and you have to set your eyes on, and then you can look at their beauty even in that darkness. So that's what I would just say.
Well, Abigail, you've clearly been that example to others. So thanks for sharing your story on the HopeCast.
Thank you for having me. Now that I have these unexpected chains, the person I was will never be the same. That person is now limited to picture frames, all because of these unexpected chains. My curly hair is now in the trash. All of a sudden, life moves 10 times fast. That life I had is now out of grasp. Unexpected chains turn a has into a had.